Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, the LA Steel Show. And tonight we're going to venture into works of a very one of my favorite philosophers, thinkers, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I've always been for many, many, many years, I've been a fan of Emerson's. Just opening up my chat room here. But for those of you who aren't familiar with his works, I highly recommend that you you look up some of his works or go to. I'm sure they have them online. Just put up Emerson. I'm sure they've got a number of his works online. But you can pick up books, essays, books of his essays. I've got quite a few of them. I'm reading tonight from an old book that was volume one of the works of Emerson. It was, I couldn't get the volume 2, 3, and 4 in the bookstore. They had volume one. But I wanted to, but that it was more than enough remarkable reading. Throughout his life, Emerson was a public speaker, lecturer, of course, prolific writer. And he became the icon of American thinking, you know, American thought. His essays inspired millions of people and throughout the world, but especially in America. And a lot of his work inspired the pioneers and the people who forged this country during the 1800s. He was a man of great conscience. He was a failed preacher, decided it wasn't for him, and that he didn't like the rigidity of religions. Even though he was a very, very God-fearing man in the sense that he appreciated the concepts. And I've always thought of him as a secular prophet. I think a lot of your works, if you go through some of his works, some of his most famous, in fact, if you look back on some of these, some of my shows, I've done a number of them. I read a number of his essays, more famous ones, The Oversoul. I believe I did The Law of Compensation and Circles. And I might have done some others, but those are the ones that I know that are in the archives. You may have to go back a ways, but they're there, back into the 207 archives, 2007, 2008 archives. But they're there, and some readings of his. So he's not new to some of my listeners, but I'm really feel that his work is so important. And this particular essay on eloquence is a it's interesting. And for those who speak publicly and for those who don't, it's an important read because it kind of explains how we talk and how we speak and the importance of eloquence and where it comes from. How we become eloquent in itself. And the latest, the latest example of eloquence was probably Susan Boyle from American Idol or English Idol or whatever it is. This woman who did not, you know, a very common and rather homely woman who had a remarkable, remarkable talent and an eloquence in her song, in her speech, in her singing that transcended all the barriers and targeted your heart and soul and spoke to you in ways that listening to that song that she sang, listening to her voice, just was remarkable. There's another gentleman that was on one of those shows also, and his name was Paul Potts, and he was an opera singer. And I swear, I've never heard opera sung like him, and I've never been as touched by a human voice like I have, like I was listening to him sing. Just a remarkable, phenomenal talent. But that's eloquence. But anyway, let me begin. Eloquence. It is the doctrine of the popular music masters that whoever can speak can sing. So probably, every man is eloquent once in his life. Our temperaments differ in capacity of heat, or we boil at different degrees. One man is brought to the boiling point by the excitement of conversation in the parlor. The waters, of course, are not very deep. He has a 2-inch enthusiasm, a patty pan ebullition. Another requires the additional calorie of a multitude and a public debate. A third needs an antagonist or a hot indignation, rather. A fourth needs a revolution, and a fifth, nothing less than the grandeur of absolute ideas, the splendors and shades of heaven and hell. But because every man is an orator, how long soever he may have been a mute, an assembly of men is so much more susceptible. The eloquence of one stimulates all the rest, some up to the speaking point and all others to the degree that makes them good receivers and conductors, and they avenge themselves for their enforced silence by increased loquacity on their return to the fireside. The plight of these phlegmatic brains is better than that of those who prematurely boil and who impatiently break the silence before their time. Our country, our county conventions often exhibit a small pot soon hot style of eloquence. We are too much reminded of a medical experiment where a series of patients are taking nitrous oxide gas. Each patient, in turn, exhibits similar symptoms: redness in the face, volubility, violent gesticulation, delirious attitudes, and occasional stamping, and alarming loss of perception of the passage of time, and a selfish enjoyment of his sensations, and loss of perception of the suffering of the audience. Oh, that's true. Whenever anybody speaks too long, I've done that myself, and many, many others have. But we get involved with our speeches, and I do that quite often, and often I will get into a rant, a rage, or whatever it may be, or wax poetic, or whatever my moods may be. But we forget when we do that our audience suffers, or may be suffering from this. And Plato says that the punishment which the wise suffer who refuse to take part in the government is to live under the government of worse men, and the like regret is suggested to all the auditors as the penalty of abstaining to speak, that they shall hear worse orators than themselves. But this lust to speak marks the universal feeling of the energy of the engine and the curiosity men feel to touch the springs. Of all the musical instruments on which men play, a popular assembly is that which has the largest compass and variety, and out of which, by genius and study, the most wonderful effects can be drawn. An audience is not a simple addition of the individuals that compose it. Their sympathy gives them a certain social organism, which fills each member in his own degree, and most of all, the orator, as a jar in a battery, is charged with the whole electricity of the battery. No one can survey the face of an excited assembly without being apprised of new opportunity for painting the fire human thought and being agitated to agitate. How many orators sit mute there below? They come to get the justice done to that ear and intuition which no Chatham and no Demosthenes has begun to satisfy. The Welsh triads say, many are the friends of the golden tongue who can wonder at the attractiveness of Parliament or of Congress or the bar for our ambitious young men when the highest bribes of society are at the feet of the successful orator. He has his audience at his devotion. All other fames must hush before his. He is the true potentate, for they are not kings who sit on thrones, but they who know how to govern. And the definitions of eloquence describe at its attraction for young men. Antiphon, the Ramnusian, one of Plutarch's 10 orators, advertised in Athens that he would cure distemper of the mind with words. No man has a prosperity for high or firm, but two or three words can dishearten it. There is no calamity which right words will not begin to redress. Socrates described his art as the power of magnifying what was small and diminishing what was great. An acute but partial definition among the Spartans, the art assumed a Spartan shape, namely of the sharpest weapon. And Socrates says, if anyone wishes to converse with the meanest of the Lacedaemonians, he will at first find him despicable in conversation. But when a proper opportunity offers, this same person, like a skillful jaculator, will hurl a sentence worthy of attention, short and contorted, so that he who converses with him will appear to be in no respect superior to a boy. And Plato's definition of rhetoric is the art of ruling the minds of men. The Quran says, a mountain may change its place, but a man will not change his disposition. Yet the end of eloquence is it not? To alter in a pair of hours, perhaps in an hour's and a half hour's discourse, the convictions and habits of years. Young men, too, are eager to enjoy the sense of added power and enlarged sympathetic existence. The orator seems himself the organ of a multitude and concentrating their valors and powers. But now the blood of 20,000 men blushed in my face, which is a quote. But that which he wishes, that which eloquence ought to reach, is not a particular skill in telling a story, or neatly summing up evidence, or arguing logically, or dexterously addressing the prejudice of the company. No, but a taking sovereign possession of the audience. Him we call an artist, who shall play on an assembly of men as a master on the keys of the piano, who seeing the people furious, shall soften and compose them, shall draw them, when he will, to laughter and to tears. Bring him to his audience, and be they who they may, coarse or refined, pleased or displeased, sulky or savage, with their opinions in the keeping of a confessor, or with their opinions in their bank safes. He will have them pleased and humored as he chooses, and they shall carry and execute that which he bids them. And that this is so true, because the power of a great orator is beyond belief. I mean, that's what, you know, given his talent, I mean, you can see Barack Obama is a very experienced, very, very, very good orator. And, you know, and so is, so are many great, so are many presidents, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, for one. But there have been so many bad orators. Like, we think of, who comes to mind first is George W. Bush, or, now any of his minions were, oh my God, any of those people in the Bush administration, none of them had any eloquence whatsoever, or refinement, or, you know, all they knew how to do is to inflame. They didn't know how to, they didn't know any other, anything else. But this is that despotism which poets have celebrated in the Pied Piper of Hamelin, who music drew like the power of gravitation, drew soldiers and priests, traitors and feasters, women and boys, rats and mice, or that of the minstrel of Mudan, who made the pallbearers dance around the bier. This is a power of many degrees and requiring in the orator a great range of faculty and experience, requiring a large composite man such as nature rarely organizes, so that in our experience we are forced to gather up the figure in fragments, here one talent and there another. The audience is a constant meter of the orator. There are many audiences in every public assembly, each one of which rules in turn. If anything comic and coarse is spoken, you shall see the emergence of the boys and rowdies who's loud and vivacious, so loud and vivacious that you might think the house was filled with them. If new topics are started, graver and higher, these roisters recede, a more chaste and wise attention takes place. You would think the boys slept, and that the men have any degree of profoundness. If the speaker utter a noble sentiment, the attention deepens. A new and highest audience now listens, and the audiences of the fun and of facts and of the understanding are all silenced and awed. There is also something excellent in every audience, the capacity of virtue. They are ready to be they are ready to be beatified. They know so much more than the orator, and are so just. There is a tablet there for every line he has inscribed, though he should mount to the highest levels. Humble persons are conscious of new illumination. Narrow brows expand and enlarged affections. Delicate spirits, long unknown to themselves, mask and muffled in coarsest fortunes, who now hear their own native language for the first time and leap to hear it. But all these several audiences, each above each, which successively appear to greet, and the variety of style and topic, are really composed of the same persons. Nay, sometimes the same individual will take active part in them all in turn. This range of many powers in the consummate speaker and of many audiences in one assembly leads us to consider the successive stages of oratory. Perhaps it is the lowest of the qualities of an orator, but it is on so many occasions of chief importance. A certain robust and radiant physical health, or shall I say, great volumes of animal heat, when each auditor feels himself to make too large a part of the assembly and shudders with cold at the thinness of the morning audience, and with fear lest all will heavily fail through one bad speech, Mere energy and mellowness are then inestimable. Wisdom and learning would be harsh and unwelcome compared with a substantial, cordial man made of milk, as we say, who is a house warmer, with his obvious honesty and good meaning, and a hue and cry style of harangue, which inundates the assembly with a flood of animal spirits and makes all safe and secure, so that any and every sort of good speaking becomes at once practicable. I do not rate this animal eloquence very highly, and yet, as we must be fed and warmed before we can do any work, well, even the best, so is this semi-animal exuberance, like a good stove of the first necessity in a cold house. So you need that everybody needs that enthusiastic audience or that enthusiastic supporter who's there to cheer you on or there to listen to you or has a great interest in what you're about to say or curiosity as to what you're about to say and is there and is willing to be there in good spirit and is like a good stove, Emerson says, of the first necessity is in a cold house. Climate has much to do with it. Climate and race. Set a New Englander to decide any accident which happened in his presence. What hesitation and reserve in his narrative. He tells with difficulty some particulars and gets as fast as he can to the result. And though he cannot describe, hopes to suggest the whole scene. This is interesting. As a New Englander, you saw this in the recent pirate happening, the Somalian pirates with the I forget his name, but the captain of the American ship Alabama, I think it was Alabama Maresk or something, but the captain of the ship was from Vermont, and you could see his genuine modesty, but his also his genuine that genuine Vermont accent, and it was charming actually. But Emerson is correct that there is part and parcel to this this New England character, which tries to get to the point quickly, and doesn't over embellish too much. So, and of course, Emerson lived in, he was a native Massachusetts resident and lived in Concord. He tells with difficulty some particulars and gets as fast as he can to the result, and though he cannot describe, hopes to suggest the whole scene. Now listen to a poor Irish woman recounting some experiences of hers. Her speech flows like a river, so unconsidered, so humorous, so pathetic, such justice done to all the parts. It is a true transubstantiation. The fact converted into speech, all warm and colored and alive, as it fell out. Our Southern people are almost all speakers and have every advantage over the New England people, whose climate is so cold that, tis said, we do not like to open our mouths very wide. But neither can the Southerner in the United States nor the Irish compare with the lively inhabitant of the south of Europe. The traveler in Sicily needs no gayer melodramatic exhibition than the table d'hôte at his inn will afford him in the conversation of the joyous guests. They mimic the voice and manner of the person they describe. They crow, squeal, hiss, cackle, bark, and scream like mad, and were it only by the physical strength exerted in telling the story keep the table in unbounded excitement. But in every constitution, some large degree of animal vigor is necessary as material foundation for the higher qualities of the art. But eloquence must be attractive, or it is none. The virtue of books is to be readable, and of orators to be interesting, and this is a gift of nature, as Demosthenes, the most laborious student in that kind, signified his sense of this necessity when he wrote, "Good fortune," as his motto on his shield. As we know, the power of discourse of certain individuals amounts to fascination, though it may have no lasting effect. Some portion of this sugar must intermingle. The right eloquence needs no bell to call the people together and no constable to keep them. It draws the children from their play, the old from their armchairs, and the invalid from his warm chamber. It holds the hearer fast, steals away his feet, that he shall not depart. His memory, that he shall not remember the most pressing affairs. His belief, that he shall not admit any opposing considerations. The pictures we have of it in semi-barbarous ages, when it has some advantages in the simpler habit of the people, show what it aims at. It is said that the Khans, or the storytellers in Isfahan and other cities of the East, attain a controlling power over their audience, keeping them for many hours attentive to the most fanciful and extravagant adventures. The whole world knows pretty well the style of these improvisators and how fascinating they are. In our translation of the Arabian Nights, and Scheherazade tells these stories to save her life, and the delight of young Europe and young America in them proves that she fairly earned it. And who does not remember in childhood some white or black or yellow Scheherazade, who, by the talent of telling endless feats of fairies and magicians and kings and queens, was more dear and wonderful to a circle of children than any orator of England or America is now. The more indolent and imaginative complexion of the Eastern nations makes them much more impressible by these appeals to the fancy. These legends are only exaggerations of real occurrences, and every literature contains these high compliments to the art of the orator and the bard, from the Hebrew and the Greek down to the Scottish Glenkindi, who hoppeth a fish out of salt water, or water out of stone, or milk out of a maiden's breast, who barren and never none. Who barren had never none. And Homer, especially delighted in drawing the same figure, For what is the Odyssey but a history of the orator in the largest style, carried through a series of adventures and furnishing brilliant opportunities to his talent? See with what care and pleasure the poet brings him on stage. Helen is pointing out to Antenor for Matower and different Grecian chiefs. Antenor said, "Tell me, dear child, who is that man shorter by a head than Agamemnon? Yet he looks broader in his shoulders and breast. His arms lie on the ground, but he, like a leader, walks about the bands of the men. He seems to me like a stately ram who goes as a master of the flock." Him answered Helen, daughter of Jove, "This is the wise Ulysses, son of Laertes, who was reared in the state of craggy Ithaca, knowing all wiles and wise counsels." To her the prudent Antenor replied again, "O woman, you have spoken truly, for once the wise Ulysses came hither on an embassy with Menelaus, beloved by Mars. I received them and entertained them at my house. I became acquainted with the genius and the prudent judgments of both. When they mixed with the assembled Trojans and stood, the broad shoulders of Menelaus rose above the others, but both sitting, Ulysses was more majestic. When they conversed and interweaved stories and opinions with all, Menelaus spoke succinctly, few but very sweet words, since he was not talkative, nor superfluous in speech, and was the younger. But when the wise Ulysses arose and spoke, and looked down, fixing his eyes on the ground, and neither moved his scepter backwards nor forwards, but held it still, like an awkward person who would say it was some angry or foolish man. But when he set his great voice forth out of his breast, and his words fell like the winter snows, not then would any mortal contend with Ulysses, and we, beholding, wondered not afterwards so much as his aspect. This he does not fail to arm Ulysses. Thus he does not fail to arm Ulysses at first with his power of overcoming all opposition by the blandishments of speech. Plutarch tells us that Thucydides, when Archimedes, king of Sparta, asked him which was the best wrestler, Pericles or he, replied, "When I throw him, he says he was never down, and he persuades the very spectators to believe him." Philip of Massus, a Don, said of Demosthenes, on hearing the report of one of his orations, "Had I been there, he would have persuaded me to take up arms against myself." And Warren Hastings said of Burke's speech on his impeachment, "As I listened to the orator, I felt for more than half an hour as if I were the most culpable being on earth." In these examples, higher qualities have already entered, but the power of detaining the earth, or rather the power of detaining the ear by pleasing speech and addressing the fancy and imagination, often exists without higher merits. Thus separated, as this fascination of discourse aims only at amusement, though it be decisive in its momentary effect, it is yet a juggle, and of no lasting power. It is heard like a band of music passing through the streets, which converts all the passengers into poets, but is forgotten as soon as it has turned the next corner. And unless the oiled tongues could, in Oriental phrase, lick the sun and moon away, it must take its place with opium and brandy. I know no remedy against it but cotton wool, or the wax which Ulysses stuffed into his ears of his sailors to pass the sirens safely. They are all degrees of power, and the least are interesting, but they must not be confounded. There is the glib tongue and the cool self-possession of the salesman in a large shop, which is well known, overpower the prudence and resolution of housekeepers of both sexes. There is a petty lawyer's fluency, which is sufficiently impressive to him who is devoid of that talent, though it be, in so many cases, nothing more than a facility of expressing with accuracy and speed what everybody thinks and says more slowly, without new information or precision of thought, but the same thing nevertheless nor more. It requires no special insight to edit one of our country's newspapers. Yet whoever can say off currently, sentence by sentence, matter neither better nor worse than what is there printed, will be very impressive to our easily pleased population. So in other words, anybody who can interpret or edit or bring down things to sound bites, basically, and that's what we do today. That's what we hear today. It's all sound bites, you know. People. That's what we respond to in our time and our need for information and our need for expedience and speed and time. everything has to be boiled down to a special certain words. And it's very difficult to do. I know everybody does that in trying to write letters or essays or articles or lectures, even preparing a plan for a school or teachers, trying to boil information down to the essence to communicate on, some very, very profound thoughts in very simple terms, if it can be done. And that is what eloquence is, when you can reach when you can grab the attention of a listener and create this image or this vision of your thought, in order to communicate that thought to your listener or to your audience. And it's a very difficult thing to do, and as many people, even the greatest of orators, have messed up. And I'll go back to this. Yet whoever can say of currently sentence by sentence matter neither better nor worse than what is there printed will be very impressive to our easily pleased population. These talkers are the class who prosper, like the celebrated schoolmaster, by being only one lesson ahead of the pupil. And it's like the journalists you hear on TV. They're one step ahead of the listener, one class ahead of the listener, because they were the first to bring this up, and then they read it on the teleprompter. A spice of malice, a ruffian touch in his rhetoric, will do him no harm with his audience. These accomplishments are of the same kind and only a degree higher than the coaxing of the auctioneer or the vituperative style, well described in the street word jawing. It's still used today. The guy is jawing. He's continually talking, saying nothing. These kinds of public and private speaking have their use and convenience to the practitioners, but we may say of such collectively that the habit of oratory is apt to disqualify them for eloquence. One of our statesmen said, "The curse of this country is eloquent men," and one cannot wonder at the uneasiness sometimes manifested by the trained statesmen with large experience of public affairs when they observe the disproportionate advantage suddenly given to oratory over the most solid and accumulated public service. It's like President Bill Clinton. He's a man who can he's a man who could excite an audience, and I believe he still can. He gets $1 million a speech. So, but in a Senate or other business committee, the solid result depends on a few men with working talent. They know how to deal with the facts before them, to put things into a practical shape, and they value men only as they can forward the work. But some new man comes there who has no capacity for helping them at all, is insignificant and nobody in the committee, but has a talent for speaking. In the debate with open doors, this precious person makes a speech which is printed and read all over the Union, and B at once becomes famous and takes the lead in the public mind over all these executive men, who of course are full of indignation to find one who has no tact or skill and knows he has none, but over them is by means of his talking power, which they despise. Doesn't that happen all the time? I mean, look at Obama. I mean, I'm sure he's hated by people who have been in politics for years, for their entire lives. and still bore their audiences or their constituents. Leaving behind us these precious, leaving behind us these pretensions, better or worse, to come a little nearer to the verity, eloquence is attractive as an example of the magic of personal ascendancy, a total and resultant power rare because it requires a rich coincidence of powers. Intellect, will, sympathy, organs, and overall good fortune in the cause. We have a half belief that the person is possible who can counterpoise all other persons. We believe that there may be a man who is a match for events, one who never found his match, against whom other men have dashed, whom other men being dashed are broken. One of inexhaustible personal resources who can give you any odds and beat you. What we really wish for is a mind equal to an exigency. You are safe in your rural district or in the city in broad daylight amidst the police and under the eyes of 100,000 people. But how is it on the Atlantic in a storm? Do you understand how to infuse your reason into men disabled by terror and to bring yourself off safe then? And how often thieves or among an infuriated populace or among cannibals, face to face with a highwayman who has every temptation and opportunity for violence and plunder, can you bring yourself off safe by your wit, exercised through speech? A problem easy enough to Caesar or Napoleon. Whenever a man of that stamp arrives, the highwayman has found a master, but as a difference between men and power of face. But what a difference between men and power of face. A man succeeds because he has more power of eye than another, and so coaxes or confounds him. The newspapers every week report the adventures of some impudent swindler who by steadiness of carriage duped those who should have known better. Now, this was written almost 200 years ago, and yet, you know, do we have the same thing today with Bernie Madoff and all the banks and all the swindlers? But yet any swindler we have known are novices and bunglers, as it's attested by their ill name. A greater power of face would accomplish anything, and with the rest of their takings, take away the bad name. The greater power of carrying the thing loftily and with perfect assurance would confound merchant, banker, judge, men of influence and power, poet and president, and might head any party, unseat any sovereign, and abrogate any constitution in Europe and America. It was said that a man has at one step attained vast power who has renounced his moral sentiment and settled it with himself that he will no longer stick at anything. It was said of Sir William Pepperell, one of the worthies of New England, that put him where you might, he commanded, and saw that he willed come to pass. Julius Caesar said to Metellus, when that tribune interfered to hinder him from entering the Roman treasury, young man, it is easier for me to put you to death than to say that I will. And the youth yielded. In earlier days, he was taken by pirates. What then? He threw himself into their ship, established the most extraordinary intimacies, told them stories, disclaimed to them. If they did not applaud his speeches, he threatened them with hanging, which he performed afterwards. And in a short time, his master was master of all on board. A man this is who cannot be disconcerted and who can never play his last card. but has a reserve of power when he has hit his mark. With his serene face, he subverts a kingdom. What is told of him is miraculous. It affects men so. The confidence of men in him is lavish, and he changes the face of the world, and histories, poems, and new philosophies arise to account for him. A supreme commander over all his passions and affections, but the secret of his ruling is higher than that. It is the power of nature running without impediment from the brain and will into the hands. Men and women are his game. Where they are, he cannot be without resource. Whoso can speak well, said Luther, is a man. It was men of this stamp that the Grecian states used to ask of Sparta for generals. They did not send to Lacedaemon for troops, but they said, send us a commander, and Pausanias or Gylippus or Brasidas or Agis was dispatched by the Ephors. It is easy to illustrate this overpowering personality by these examples of soldiers and kings, but there are men of the most peaceful way of life and peaceful principle who are felt wherever they go as sensibly as a July sun or a December frost, men who, if they speak, are heard, though they speak in a whisper, who, when they act effectively, and what they do is imitated. And these examples may be found on very humble platforms as well as on high ones. And in old countries, a high money value is set on the... High money value is set on, I can't find the page here, it's very thin pages. Bear with me. I didn't think it would be that difficult, but this is a very old book. And the pages are very thin. In all countries, a high money value is set on the services of men who have achieved a personal distinction. He who has points to carry must hire, not a skillful attorney, but a commanding person. A barrister in England is reputed to have made £20,000 or £30,000 per year in representing the claims of railroad companies before committees of the House of Commons. His clients pay not so much for legal as for manly accomplishments, for courage, conduct, and a commanding social position which enabled him to make their claims heard and respected. And this happens to this day. We hear about it all the time. You know, we see generals, former generals, retired generals, they're always speaking. You know, they hire all these former CEOs of big companies to be pundits and experts to come on the news and come on television and tell you the way it is, you know. So that's been a common practice for millennium, okay, since the early Greeks and Romans, and we do the same thing today, only it's on television and radio. I've yet to see too many very good speakers, really. Speakers that can command an audience. I believe Barack Obama is probably the closest to a great speaker that we've had in many, many, many years. People who were involved with his words, he was able to command the attention of his audience without too much skepticism, without too much... Too much boredom, and that's what made him president, basically. I know very well that among our cool and calculated people, there where every man mounts guard over himself, where heats and panics and abandonments are quite out of the system. There is a good deal of skepticism as to the extraordinary influence. To talk of an overpowering mind rouses the same jealousy and defiance which one may observe round a table where everybody or where anybody is recounting the marvelous anecdotes of mesmerism or hypnotism. Each auditor put a final stroke to the discourse by exclaiming, "Can he mesmerize me?" So each man inquires if any orator can change his convictions. And years ago, I knew a hypnotist who I once asked, can you actually hypnotize somebody to buy a product? I was a salesman at the time. Can you hypnotize someone into buying a product? And he says, yeah. He says, you can hypnotize people into doing anything. Basically, he says, but, you know, you have to be careful with the words you choose or the tone that you inflect. But this guy was a professional hypnotist, and he said, yeah, you know, you can. Yeah, you people are very susceptible to hypnosis. And they are hypnotized without even being aware that they're being hypnotized. That happens to us all the time on television. Whenever we watch TV, we're, you know, glued to that television set or to the internet or to whatever we're glued to. And it's all a form of hypnosis to subvert the conscious, attract the subconscious of an individual. But does anyone suppose himself to be quite impregnable? Does he think that it is not possible that a man may come to him who shall persuade him out of his most settled determination? And we have this all the time. Somebody brings up a better idea or communicates something perfectly, and we change the way we think. For example, good sedate citizen as he is, to make a fanatic of him. He can be a sedate citizen and make a fanatic out of him. Or if he is pernicious, to squander money for some purpose he now thinks of. Or if he is a prudent, industrious person, to forsake his work and give days and weeks to a new interest. No, he defies anyone, everyone. He is thinking of resistance and of a different turn from his own. But what if no one comes of the same turn of mind as his own and who sees much farther on his own way than he? A man who has tastes like mine, but in greater power, will rule me any day and make me love my ruler. Boy, isn't that the case? Isn't that the truth? That's what so many people do. I mean, if you identify with your Republican or candidate or Democratic candidate or whatever, or whoever, if you identify with an ideological idea or philosophy that somebody has, then you are automatically going to win that person over, okay? Because he's like you. He thinks like you do. And you know, so you're speaking to your audience, and you speak to your choir. And as you speak to your choir, you know, in many ways, you can hypnotize your audiences, visually, auditorially, and physically. You know? Thus, it is not powers of speech that we primarily consider under this word eloquence, but the power that being present gives them their perfection, and being absent leaves them a merely superficial value. Eloquence is the appropriate organ of the highest personal energy, personal ascendancy, may exist with or without adequate talent for its expression. It is an it is as surely felt as a mountain or a planet. But when it is weaponed with the power of speech, it seems first to become truly human, works actively in all directions, and supplies the imagination with fine materials. This circumstance enters into every consideration of the power of orators, and is the key to all their effects. In the assembly, you shall find the orator and the audience in perpetual balance, and the predominance of either is indicated by the choice of topic. If the talents of speaking exists, but not the strong personality, then there are good speakers who perfectly receive and express the will of the audience, and the commonest populace is flattered by hearing its low mind returned to it with every ornament which happy talent can add. But if there is personality in the orator, the face of things changes. The audience is thrown into the attitude of a pupil and follows like a child its preceptor and hears what he has to say. It is as if amid the King's Council of Madrid, Ximenes urged that an advantage might be gained of France and Mendoza, that Flanders might be kept down, and Columbus being introduced was interrogated whether his geographical knowledge could aid the cabinet. And he can say nothing to one party or to the other, but he can show how all Europe can be diminished and reduced under the king by annexing to Spain a continent as large as six of seven Europes. And this is what diplomacy is. You know, this is what the art of diplomacy is, eloquence. This is what the art of salesmanship is. And the art of winning a conversation, if you will, or debate, the degree of eloquence, the degree the degree of good humor, the degree of patience, and you know, I think of Ronald Reagan, for instance, and how he toyed with the people, and he always had jokes, or he always had images that he portrayed, or visuals that he gave, and that made people wow. You know, they could see them, and he kind of spoke to the people in parables, if you will, and that was what made him a great orator, not so much a great president, because he did a lot of things that were heinous, horrendous, but at the same time, his oratory and his ability to speak put him down in history as, you know, a great speaker and a great communicator, and he's more remembered for that. And we have about a minute left, and I want to thank everybody for joining me tonight. We did. Somebody new here, Lioness of Angels, I'm glad you joined me. And of course, Cryptic, thank you for coming in. And many of you didn't pick up the first part of the show, but we were talking about the essay of eloquence by Ralph Waldo Emerson, and I thought it would be appropriate comparing that to Obama and all of the so many. I didn't get through it tonight. Unfortunately, I got through about maybe half of it, but. I hope that it piqued your interest, and possibly I can read the remainder of it next week. But in the meantime, I want to thank everybody for joining me, and I wish you a very good evening. Good night. Oh, by the way, please join us tomorrow. And tomorrow night we'll have George Dixon with us. We hope he's feeling better, and everything is good, and we'll be talking to him tomorrow night. Thank you, and have a pleasant evening.